There was doom in these thoughts, so she shied away from them. The crowds grew, as did the agitation and turmoil. The closer they came to the palace, the more complicated their passage became. Most people fought their way eastward, frantic to escape whatever was happening behind them. Others, curious, and those who, like Esmonet, had kin in the vicinity of the palace, battled their way eastward. Twice Imhalus stopped to ask aimless columnaries what happened, and twice he was rebuffed. No one knew. Even still, hope wormed ever higher into her throat as they raced, dodged and shoved. She found herself thinking of a Polarian, an Eothic guardsman, how competent, how numerous, and how loyal they seemed. For years she had dwelt among them, thoughtlessly demanding the security they provided, but never really appreciating them. Until now. They were hand-picked, chosen from across the Middle North for their prowess and fanaticism. They had spent the greater portion of their lives preparing for occasions such as this, she reminded herself. If anything, they lived for just such an eventuality. They would defend the imperial precincts, secure the palace. They would keep her children safe. Breathless, she imagined them bristling along the walls, arrayed about the gates, glorious in their crimson and gold regalia. She saw old Vem Mithridi standing high upon some parapet, his stooped shoulders pulled back with outrage and indignation, raining down sorcerous destruction. She saw old Ngarau waddling in a walrus-armed panic, barking out commands. And her boy, her beautiful boy, frightened yet too young not to be exhilarated, not to think this some kind of glorious game. Yes, the gods would not heap this calamity upon her. She had paid their bloodthirsty wages. The world would rally. But the smoke climbed ever higher as they raced through the ever more raucous streets, until she felt she stared up into a tree for craning her neck. The faces of those fleeing became ever more sealed, more intent. The roaring, shouts from the crowded rooftops, from the seething streets, seemed to grow louder and louder. "The palace burns!" one old crone cried immediately next to her. "The Emperor's whore is dead! Dead!" And in the crash of hope into dismay, she remembered. The gods hunted her and her children. The white luck had turned against them. At last they pressed their way free of the slotted streets onto the processional with its broad views. Were it not for Imhalus and his strength, the mobs would have defeated her, prevented her from seeing the catastrophe with her own eyes. He pulled her by the wrists, cursing and shoving, and she followed with the pendulum limbs of a doll. Then suddenly they were clear, panting, among the crowd's forward ranks. A cohort of unmarted Shrial knights guarded the bridges crossing the Rat Canal, as much to police the mob, it seemed, as to ward against any attempt to retake the imperial precincts. The fortifications rising beyond were deserted. She glimpsed pockets of battle here and there, across the climbing jumble of structure that composed the Endymion Heights. Distant figures vying, their swords catching the sun. Smoke poured in liquid ribbons from the Elysium form. Three other plumes climbed from palaces unseen beyond the palace. Imhalus need not say anything. The battle was over. The new empire had been overthrown in the space of an afternoon. Planning, she realized. An assault this effective required meticulous planning. Time. The Empress of the Three Seas stood breathless. An errant hand held her veil, gazing at the loss of everything she had known for the past 20 years. The theft of her power, the destruction of her home, the captivity of her children, the overturning of her world. Fool! A thought like a cold draft in a crypt. Such a fool! Vying against an Asarimbar Mathanet, crossing swords with a Dunyain, who knew the folly of this better than she? She turned to Imhalus, who stood as immobile and aghast as she. "'We,' she murmured, only to trail. "'We have to go back.' He looked down into her eyes, squinted in confusion. "We have to go back," she cried under her breath. I'll throw myself at his feet. Beg for mercy. Seju. I have to do something." He cast a wary glance across those packed close about them. "Yes, your glory," he said intently, speaking below the mob's rumble. "You must do something. This is treason, sacrilege. But if you deliver yourself to him, you will be executed. Do you understand? He cannot afford your testimony." Threads of light tangled and distorted his face. She was blinking tears. When had she started weeping? Since coming to Kellis's bed, it seemed. Since abandoning Akka. "All the more reason for you to leave me, Imhalis. Flee, while you still can." A smiling frown creased his face. "Damnation doesn't agree with me, Holy Empress." Another one of his quotations. She sobbed and laughed in exasperation. "I'm not asking, Imhalis. I am commanding. Save yourself." But he was already shaking his head. "This I cannot do." She'd always thought him a fop, a thick-fingered dandy. She had always wondered what it was that Kellis had seen in him, to raise him so high, so fast. As a courtier, he could be almost comically timid. Always bowing and scraping, stumbling over himself in his haste to execute her wishes. But now... now she could see Imhalis as he really was. A warrior. He was, at his pith, a true warrior. Defeat did not break his heart so much as stir his blood. "You don't know Imhalis. You don't know Mathanet, the way I know him. I know that he is cunning and treacherous. I know that he pollutes the holy office your husband has given to him. Most of all, I know you have already done what you needed to do."
I...
She trailed, wiped her nose, and squinted up at him.
"What are you saying?"
"You have loosed the Narinder." He was inventing his rationale as he spoke. She could see this in his inward gaze, hear it in his searching tone. He would stand by her side, die for her, not for any tactical or even spiritual reason, but because sacrificing his strength on the altar of higher things was simply what he did. This is why Kellis had given him to her. "All that remains is to wait," he continued, warming to the sense of what he said. "Yes, we must hide and wait. And when the Narinder strikes, all will be chaos. Everyone will be casting about, searching for authority. That's when you reveal yourself, your glory." She so wanted to believe him, so wanted to pretend that the holy shrine of the thousand temples was not a Dunyane.
"But my boy, my daughter!"
"Are children of your husband, the Aspect Emperor, Anna Sarimba Kellis." Esmond gasped. So sudden was her understanding.
Yes, he was right. Mathanet would not dare to kill them, not so long as Kellis lived.
Even so far from the northern wastes, they dwelt in the chill shadow of the holy Aspect Emperor's power, as did all men.
"Hide," she repeated. "But how? Where? They are all against me, Imhalis. In Rithi, Yatwirians."
And yet, even as she voiced these fears, implications began assembling about the mere fact of her husband.
This, she realized.
This is why Kellis had left her the imperial mantle. She did not covet it. How could one covet what one despised? "Not me, your glory, nor any guardsman living, I assure you. Kellis would succeed, and he would return. He always conquered. Even Moengus, his father, could not overcome him. Kellis would return, and when he did, there would be a horrible accounting." Imhalis clasped her hands in his own. "I know of a place. She need only live long enough to see it done. He will come back for us." She made a litany of this thought as they fled back into the city proper.
"Kellis will return.
When despair reeled through her, the sense of skidding backward into doom. He will return. When she imagined Thalaipa, sitting rigid in her room, staring into her hands as Mathanet's shadow darkened the threshold. He will! He will! When she saw Mathanet kneel before Kel'Momas, grasp his slender shoulders between his hands. He will kill him with his own hands! And it seemed she could see him, her glorious husband, stepping from spiking light to stride across the city, calling out his brother's treacherous name. And it pulled her breath sharp, wound her teeth tight, stretched her lips into an animal grin. The fury of his judgment. Then she found herself in a lantern-lit foyer, standing and blinking while Imhalis muttered in low tones to an armed man even taller than he was. The tile work, the frescoed ceiling, everything possessed an air of opulence, but a false one, she quickly realized, seeing the grimed corners and grouting, the myriad chips and cracks, details that shouted an inability to support slaves. Then Imhalis was leading her up marble stairs. She wanted to ask him where they were going, but she could not speak around the confusion that bloated through her. At last they gained a gloomy corridor. Her breathlessness, years had passed since she had last traveled such distances on foot, became a sense of floating suffocation. She stood blinking while he hammered on a broad wooden door. She scarcely glimpsed the face, dark and beautiful, that anxiously greeted him. A room beyond, yellow-painted, dimly illuminated.
"Imma! Sweet Seju! I was wi-
Nari, please!" the exalt captain cried, shouldering the woman back, hustling Esmenet into the dimly lit interior without begging permission. He shut the door behind them, turned to the two astounded women. The girl was no taller than Esmenet, but she was darker of complexion, younger, and beautiful, very beautiful. Despite her appearance and accent, it was actually her costume, a gaudy glass-beaded affair that made Esmenet realize this Nari was Nil-Nemeshi. Nari, for her part, appraised Esmenet with open distaste. "This will cost you, Imma," she said skeptically. And Esmenet understood, the tone as much as anything else. Nari was a whore. Imhalis had brought her to his whore. "Stop playing the fool and grab her a bowl of water," he cried, grabbing Esmenet by the shoulders, guiding her to a battered settee. Her eyes could not make sense of the room relative to the movements of her body. Everything whirled, breathless. Why was she so breathless? Then she was sitting, and her exalt captain was kneeling before her. "Who is she?" Nari asked, returning with water. Imhalis raised the bowl for her to drink. "She's not right. The day..." Nari stared, her face slack in the way of long-time victims assessing threats. Her eyes popped wide, rings of shining white about dark, dark irises. She was a whore. Innumerable silver kelics had passed through her hands, each bearing the image of the woman before her. "Sweet mother of birth! It's you!" A wave crashed through the Endymion Heights, swirling into the corridors, rising ever higher. Foaming blood, it battered down doors. It threw itself howling into braced mobs of Eothic guardsmen. It clutched welling wounds, grunting and crying out. It slumped dying in the corners of raucous rooms. Slipping through hollow walls, the young Prince Imperial tracked its grim progress. He watched men hacking and grappling, murdering in the name of symbol and color. He saw flames leap from ornament to ornament. He watched astounded slaves beaten, and in one instance, raped. And it seemed a miracle that he could be alone while witnessing such heroism and atrocity. Never had the end of the world been so much fun. He knew full well what he had witnessed, a coup, nearly flawless in its execution, the fall of the Endymion Heights. He knew that his uncle would rule the empire ere the day was done, and that his mother would either be a captive or a fugitive.
But he did not think of the unthinkable consequence, that she would be executed. It was because he knew he was responsible, and nothing he authored could lead to anything so disastrous. He had made this happen. There was a clenching glee to this thought, an elation that at times barked as a laugh from his lungs, such was its intensity. And it seemed the palace itself became his model, the replica he had decided to break and burn. Uncle Holy, for all his danger, was but one more tool. He was the god here, the four-horned brother. Wires of smoke coiled beneath the vaults, hazed the gilded corridors. Slaves and costumed functionaries fled. Armored men rallied, charged, and grappled, as colorful as new toys. The gold on white surcoats of the Shrial Knights, the crimson of the Iothic Guard, the gold on green of the Polarians. He watched a company of these latter defend the antechambers to the audience hall. Time and again they broke the knights of the Tusk who assailed them, killing so many they began using their bodies as improvised barricades. Only when the Inchosti, the bodyguard of the Holy Shrier himself, assaulted them, were the fanatics finally overcome. Their willingness to die left Kel'Momas breathless. For him, he realized. They sacrificed themselves for him and his family. The fools. He glimpsed or watched a dozen such melees moving down the heights. Isolated pockets of violence. The palace's defenders always outnumbered, always fighting to the desperate last. He listened to the curses and catcalls they traded. The Shrial Knights beseeching their foes to surrender. To yield the mad whore, the Polarians and guardsmen promising doom and damnation for their foes' treachery. Exploring the palace's lower tracks, below the rising tide of battle, he saw rooms and corridors strewn with dead, and he witnessed the savagery that so often leaps into the void of power overthrown. He watched one of his mother's operati, an Enani, named Menacasis, rape and strangle a slave girl, assuming the crime would be attributed to the invaders, the astonished boy supposed. And then there were the looters, Shrial Knights, pairs usually, who found themselves happily separated from their companies, ranging halls they believed already cleared. Kel'Momas found one solitary fool rummaging through a room in the apparatory, rending the mattress, rifling the wardrobe, hacking open a small chest and kicking the baubles he found in disgust. The room was windowless, so the boy peered through a ventilation grill tucked in a corner. He watched with fascination, realizing that he witnessed avarice in its purest, most impatient form. It almost seemed a mummer's act, as if a starving ape had been dressed in shrial regalia, then sent scavenging for the amusement of unseen patrons. Even before he realized his intent, Kel'Momas began snuffling audibly, weeping the way a frightened little boy might. The Knight of the Tusk fairly jumped clear out of his hauberk and surcoat. Such was his surprise. He whirled from side to side. Several heartbeats passed before he mastered his alarm and listened, before he realized it was a child that he heard. Someone harmless. A leering smile cracked his beard. "Shh," he drawled, scanning the high corners, for he realized the sound came from above. The Prince Imperial continued weeping, making the sound of a derelict child. His face ached for the manic ferocity of his grin. The sounds hooked the man's gaze. He kicked a chair to the corner, mounted it.
"Mommy!"
the boy sobbed, hitching his voice into a high whine. The man's face loomed before the iron fretting, darkened by its own shadow. His breath reeked of cheap liquor. The crawlspace was so cramped that Kel'Momas bungled his strike, driving his skewer through the man's pupil rather than his tear duct. Strange sensation, that, like popping the skin of a grape. The man's face clenched about the intrusion, a fist without fingers. He toppled, fell flat on his back, where he jerked in a strange parody of a fool's caper, like a beetle flicked onto its back.
"Look at him,"
the secret voice chortled. "Yes," Kel'Momas cackled. He even clapped his hands, such was his raw delight. Afterward, when night fell and silence hardened the acrid air, he toured the labyrinth of small battlefields,
taking care lest he track bloody footprints across the expansive floors. He had thought he would find glory wandering among the dead, but all he witnessed were its dregs. Nothing remained of the desperation, the shouts and cries of mortal struggle. There was no distinguishing the heroic from the craven. The dead were dead, utterly helpless and invulnerable. The more he counted them, the more they seemed to laugh. Eventually he stood marooned, silence pricking his ears. "Mommy?" he finally dared call. The dead did not so much as twitch. At long last his face-cracking grin faded, and a weeper's grimace rose to take its place. There had been a heartbeat upon awakening when nothing seemed amiss. Where she need only blink and stretch and groan her morning groan to summon her body slaves and their soothing ministrations. A heartbeat. But horror, true horror, dwells in the body as much as the soul. She needed only raise her arms to recall the madness of the previous day, the pinioned breath, the curious mismatch between motion and effort, as if her sinews had become sand, her bones lead. The seashell roar. Lying prostrate across a narrow cot, the blessed empress of the three seas plummeted and plummeted, clutching his thoughts too sharp with fingers too cold, fumbling with knives. The palace lost, her husband betrayed. Kelmomus, sweet little Kelmomus. She tried curling into a ball, tried weeping, but tears and sobs seemed things too heavy to be moved. Too frail had her innards become. A crazed, floating restlessness inhabited her instead, where the most she could do was throw her limbs, flop them this way and that, like things. Dead things, continually in the way of themselves. But even this effort defeated her, so she lay motionless, thrashed within, as if she were a greased worm, writhing against appendages too slippery to hold. "Please," a girlish voice whispered, "your glory." Esmond had opened her eyes, blinking. Even though she had yet to weep, she could feel the itch of swollen lids. Nerie knelt next to the cot, her large eyes round with fear, her luxurious hair hanging in sheets about her plump cheeks. The far window shone white over her shoulder, gleamed across the yellow-painted walls.
"I need you to stay here," the girl said, tears spilling down her cheeks.
She was terrified, Esmonette realized. As she should be. Imhalis had delivered a burden she could not bear.
Just stay here, yes? Keep your face to the wall?"
Without a word, the blessed empress of the three seas turned from the girl toward the cracked paint and plaster. What else was there to do? Watches passed, and she did not move, not until the need to make water overpowered her. Only her listening roamed, between uncertain faces, beneath damp sheets. "Who is that?"
"My mother."
"Mother?"
"Pay her no heed."
"But I will—"
"No, please. Heed this instead."
Four different men visited the girl, but they seemed one and the same creature in Esmonette's ears. The same half-hearted flatteries, carnal witticisms, the same nostril-pinching intakes of breath, the same moans and giggles, the same rasp of grinding hair, the same cries. The same liquid drumbeat. Only the stench varied. And it repelled her even as her inner thighs grew slick. It shamed her, to conjure the miracle of intimacy, to become one breathless creature while still wearing the skin of strangers. She coupled with them anew that afternoon, all the men she had known as a harlot. She saw them skulking in from the open streets, their eyes clouded with need, offering silver instead of wooing, proving, loving. She laughed as she teased, gagged, as she choked, huddled beneath the apish rage of the impotent, gasped beneath the slow stir of the beautiful. She gloated over coins, dreamed of the food she would buy, the cloth. She wept for the loss of her empire. There was a lull after the fourth man departed. The clatter and shout of the street climbed through the unshuttered windows, rang with the stark clarity of plastered walls and tiled floors. A man with a cracked voice bellowed, boasting the curative power of his sulfured cider. A dog snarled and barked, obviously old and frightened. Esmonette finally turned from the wall, her bladder so full she could scarce contain herself. Even after all this time, the room was a mystery to her. It was far larger than any room Esmonette had been able to afford in Sumna, but then, for all her beauty, she had not been an outlander like Nerie. And Sumna had never seen the wealth that had concentrated in Momon since Kellis's rise to power. Two windows looked onto the sun-drenched facade of the tenement across the street. One housing more prostitutes, she realized, glimpsing two pale-skinned Nosarai girls sitting on sills. The far window illuminated a small scullery, a water basin upon a wooden counter, a standing amphora, pottery-stacked shelves, and various herbs hanging to dry. The near window showered light across Nerie's bed, which was a broad, extravagant affair, constructed of black lacquered mahogany. Esmonette's cot was set parallel to the bed on the far side of the door. The girl lay naked across the tangled covers, staring from the ridge of her pillow. The fugitive empress of the three seas gazed back with numb urgency. She knew the exhaustion in Nerie's eyes, the dull throb of her sex, the faint pinch of seed drying across bare skin, the peculiar sense of having survived. She knew the disjoint chorus that was the girl's soul, the voice counting coins, the voice fending against despair, the voice flinching from the fact of what had just happened, and the voice urging her to betray her empress. Nerie was broken, that much was certain. Even the priestesses of Giera, who sold themselves with the sanction of God and temple, were broken. To sell intimacy is to be turned inside out, to make a cloak of your heart, so that others might be warmed. A soul could only be inverted so many times before it all became confused, inside and outside. Broken. Esmonette could see the cracks floating in her watery gaze. The only real question was one of how. Selling peaches did not so much rob a soul of trust or dignity or compassion as it robbed these words of their common meaning. Nerie believed in trust, jealously guarded her dignity, felt compassion, but in ways utterly peculiar to her. "I need to pee," Esmonette finally said. Sorry, the girl cried, leaping from her bed. She ran to the screen that flanked her settee. She pulled back one of the faded embroidered panels, and with a mummer's flourish, revealed a white porcelain chamber pot. Esmonette thanked her sheepishly. "Nerie!" an accented voice cried from out of doors. One of the Galeoth girls, hanging her thighs from a window opposite.
"Nerie! Who dat you hat with you?"
"Mind your own sheets," the Nilameshi girl cried, hastening to close the shutters on the near window. The whore cackled the way Esmonette had heard countless times before.
"Brushing rugs, eh?"
Fairly in a terror, Nerie explained how they all kept their windows unshuttered when attending to their custom, for safety.
"I know," Esmonette said. "I used to do the same."
Suddenly she realized the impossibility of her circumstance. Nerie, like most people of Hale Heart, knew all her neighbors and was known by them. Esmonette knew firsthand the way city dwellers roped themselves into small tribes and villages, caring for one another, envying, spying, hating. More shutters clattered and the room darkened while she attended to her bladder. When she stepped from behind the screen, she found Nerie in the gloom, still naked, sitting cross-legged on her bed, weeping. Without thinking, she took the girl's slender shoulders in her arms, pulled her into a mother's embrace.
"Shush,"
the Holy Empress said. She thought of the famine, the way Maimara had seemed to retreat further into her bones with every passing day. She thought of the way she had torn in two, walking with her to the slavers in the harbor. The hum of disbelief, the goad of numb necessity, the little fingers clasping hers in anxious trust. And she wished, with a violence that rolled her eyes, that she had simply held on to those bones, folded them within the squalid circle of her own, and died with her only daughter. My Mara, the one thing unsold.
I understand.
How long had it been since she had kept company with her past? Esmonet sat with the girl until the glaring white lines that etched the shutters paled to gray. Nuri did not know her age, only that 5 years had passed since her flowering. She had been raised a Yatarissa, a ritual harem slave popular among the Nilnameshi caste nobility. Her owner had possessed estates both in Mbishi, where they wintered, and in the Hinayati Mountains, where they spent the plague months of summer. She had loved him fiercely. Apparently he was a gentle, caring man, one who lavished her with gifts to atone for the inevitable injuries he inflicted on her. The great catastrophe in her life, her year zero, came with her first bleeding. Rather than sell her to a brothel, as was the fate of most Yatarissa, her owner set her free. Almost immediately she became the mistress of another caste noble, a trade representative, who had been sent to Momin almost 4 years ago. He was the one who had purchased the Yellow Room and its sumptuous furnishings. Nuri loved him well, but when his year-long tenure expired, he simply moved his wife and household back to Mbishi without saying a word. She began selling herself almost immediately. Esmonet found herself listening with two souls, the one, the old whore, almost contemptuous of the cozened luxury that had characterized so much of the girl's life, the other, the aging mother, horrified at the way she had been used and cast away, only to be used and cast away again. "I want to help you," the girl cried. "Imma, I... Thus is cruelty always explained away. A life of suffering. A life where simple survival seems an unaccountable risk. A life too damaged to continent's heroism. Esmonet tried to imagine what she would have done those years, had one of her customers come to her with a fugitive of any description, let alone the Empress of the Three Seas. She wanted to think she would be fearless, generous, but she knew that she would do what fate demanded all prostitutes do. Betray in the name of survival. Only Akka could have coaxed such a risk from her, she realized. Only love. Suddenly she understood the girl's torment. Nuri loved Imhalis. She had made him the sum of her simple hopes. Were he just another man, she would have resorted to the grim, guarded manner that prostitutes typically use to distance people they were forced to hurt. But he was not, and he had come to her demanding a mortal favor. People had died, people were dying, because of her, and Asrimbar Esmonet. From this moment on, she realized, she had become a mortal risk to anyone who so much as glimpsed her without alerting the Shrial Knights. From this moment on, she was the most sought-after fugitive in all the Three Seas. "Please!" Nuri cried, her voice piteous for her accent. "Please, blessed Empress, you must find some other place. You're not safe here. There are too many people." But Nuri, she knew, wasn't simply asking her to hide elsewhere. The girl was asking her to take responsibility for leaving as well, so that she might salvage her relationship with Imhalis. And were it not for her children, Esmonet probably would have done exactly as she asked. "Why?" a masculine voice asked from behind them. Both women gasped, started violently enough to pop some joint in the bed. Imhalis stood by the door, cloaked as before, staring at Nuri in naked outrage. The combination of gloom and surprise made him seem an apparition. "Why are we not safe?" The girl instantly dropped her eyes. Some habit from her childhood bondage, Esmonet supposed. Imhalis strode around the bed, glaring in fury. The floorboards creaked beneath his booted feet. The girl continued staring down in submissive immobility. "What is this?" he snapped, tugging at the blanket she had pulled about her shoulders. The girl caught an exposed breast with a forearm. "You've been taking custom?" he cried in low, incredulous tones.
"Emma,"
she called, at last looking up. Tears streamed from her eyes. The blow was sudden, hard enough to send the slight girl rolling across the mattress. Imhalis hauled her upright, pinned her writhing against the wall before Esmonette could find her voice, let alone her feet. The girl clawed at the hand about her throat, gurgled and gagged. The exult captain pulled his knife, raised the point before her wide and rolling eyes. "Should I send you to them now?" he grated. "Should I let the Hundred judge you now? Why, you stink for rutting before your holy empress? Should I send you to them polluted?" Esmonette circled around him, as though in a dream.
When did I become so slow?
A vague portion of her soul wondered. When had the world become so fast? She raised the palm to the wrist of the choking hand. Imhalis looked at her, his eyes wild and bright, and clouded with madness that is the terror of all women. He blinked, and she watched him catch himself on the murderous brink.
"Shush, Emma," she said,
using the diminutive of his name for the first time. She met his astounded gaze with a warm smile.
"Your blessed empress, remember, happens to be an old whore."
The exult captain released the naked girl, who slumped to the tiles, gagging and weeping. He stepped back. Esmonette crouched over the girl, hesitated, her soul caught on the humming threshold of compassion.
"Your children," she thought with a kind of inward torsion.
"No enemy is so relentless as a forgiving nature."
"Tell Momus, remember him. I'm your Empress Nari. Do you know what that means?"
Esmonette reached towards Imhalis, gestured for his knife. "His palms are hotter than mine," she thought, as her fingers closed about the warm leather of the grip. Even skinned in tears, there was something crisp and vigilant about the girl's eyes, a troubling alacrity in the way they clicked from the shining blade to Esmonette's own gaze. As young as she was, Esmonette realized, Nari was an inveterate survivor.
"It means," Esmonette said, her smile as warm and motherly as the knife's edge was wicked, "that your life, Nari, belongs to me."
The girl swallowed and nodded with the same air of learned submission. Esmonette pressed the knife's point against the soft curve of her throat.
"Your soul,"
the blessed empress of the three seas continued, "belongs to my husband." "Maethanet has loosed an army of priests across the city," Imhalis said, leaning back in exhaustion across the battered settee. Nari, now robed and almost comically meek, sat cross-legged on the floor at his feet, holding up a bowl of watered wine in yet another pose of ritual subservience. Esmonette sat in the corner of her cot, watching them, hunched forward with her elbows on her thighs. The world beyond the shutters had gone black. A single lantern illuminated the room, casting haphazard shadows through ochre gloom. "Criers," the exult captain continued, "only decked in full vestments, swinging censers on staffs." His eyes latched on Esmonette in the gloom, the lamplight reflected in two shining white dots low on his irises. "He's saying you've gone mad, Your Glory, that you have betrayed your husband." The words winded her, even though she was entirely unsurprised. Maethanet need not be Dunyane to understand the importance of legitimacy. Kellis had explained nations and polities to her, how they worked like the Serangi automata, so prized by the more fashionable caste nobility. "All states are raised upon the backs of men," he had told her after the final capitulation of High Anon. "Their actions, the things they do day in and day out, connect like wheels and cogs, from the stonemason to the tax farmer, to the body slave. And all actions are raised upon the back of belief. When men turn from their beliefs, they turn from their actions. Then the entire mechanism fails." "So this is why I must lie?" she asked, watching him from her pillow. He smiled the way he always did when she missed his mark, in a penetrating manner. No. To think in these terms, Esme, is to think honesty is the decision that confronts you. What is the decision, then?
He shrugged. Effectiveness. The masses will always be mired in falsehood. Always. Each man will think he believes true, of course. Many will even weep for the strength of their conviction. So if you speak truth to their deception, they will call you a liar and cast you from power. The ruler's only recourse is to speak oil, to communicate in ways that facilitate the machine. Sometimes this oil will be truth, perhaps, but more often it will be lies. Speaking oil. Of all the analogies he used to illustrate the deeper meaning of things, none would trouble her quite so much. None would remind her so much of a commune and his fateful warning.
But
how did I rise to power? He asked, seeing her thoughts as always. A rueful smile as if remembering escapades best forgotten. Men make what they already believe the measure of what is true or false. What they call reason is simply apology. The masses will always believe false because the fancy of their forefathers is always their rule. I rose to power by giving them truths, little truths, for which they possessed no rule, one after the other. I chased the unthought implications of what they already believed, gaining ever more legitimacy until, eventually, men made me their one and only rule. Insurrection is me. I waged a long, hard insurrection. The petty overthrow of petty assumptions precedes all true upheavals of belief.
So you lied?
A small smile.
I guided them to a lesser falsehood. Then what is the truth?
He had laughed, shining, as if anointed in oil. You would call me a liar if I told you, he had said. Both Imhalis and Rhee stared at her in anxious expectation, and it seemed a miracle to her that she could be so powerless in fact, and yet hold souls such as these in her thrall, simply because they believed she possessed power over them, the way countless thousands believed she realized. Maethanet had removed the new empire's head, her. Now he was simply doing what any usurper would, speaking oil. He had to give the masses an excuse to continue acting in all the old ways. Otherwise, all the wheels and cogs would cease turning in concert, and the entire mechanism would come crashing down. Every palace revolt took this form. Only the precision and alacrity of his execution distinguished him as Dunyehin. The people will never believe him, Imhalis finally cried when she failed to speak. I'm sure of it. A wave of resignation washed over her.
Yes, she said, dropping her forehead into her palm. They will.
His story was simple enough, believable enough. The machine was broken, and he, Maethanet, was the chosen tinker.
How? How could they?
Because he has reached them first. The three of them soaked in the implications of this disastrous fact. One could not dwell in the presence of Anna Sarimba Kellis as long as she had without developing an acute awareness of one's own soul. The thoughts, the passions, and most importantly, the patterns. If she lacked insight before, it was simply because she had occupied the center of power for so long. Nothing so deadens the inner eye as habit. But now, Maethanet had obliterated everything she had known, and it seemed she could see herself with a peculiar lucidity. The fugitive empress, the bereaved mother, the cycling of dismay, desolation, hatred, and a curious in-between, a sense as relentless as it was numb, the going through the motions of survival. Numbness. This was the only strength she possessed, so she strained to hold on to it. "He's calling himself the Imperial Custodian," Imhalis continued, his eyes tearing for frustration and disgust. "What of the army?" Esmenet heard herself ask.
Only the pain in her throat told her the importance of this question. As anxious and solemn as she had appeared before, Imhalus looked to her with outright horror now. "They say Anthyril has met with him in Temple Zothe," he said, "that the traitor has publicly kissed his knee." Esmond wanted to lash out in crazed fury, to punish petty things for the epic injustices she had suffered. She wanted to shriek in imperious outrage, heap loathing and curses upon General Anthyril, everyone who had surrendered their capricious loyalty. But she found herself looking at Nerea upon the floor below Imhalus instead. The girl glanced at her, a bright, almost animal look, only to turn away in terror. The girl was trembling, Esmond realized. Only the palm and arm she held, posed to receive Imhalus's wine bowl, remained motionless. And the holy empress of the three seas tasted something she had not known since the crazed day she had led her daughter to the slavers in the harbor so many years before. Defeat.